Welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk. That's me, and I'm so glad you're here. If you like what we do, I'd love it if you gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you're so compelled, write a review. That really helps, and maybe tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. If you want to get involved in the program, visit our website, talkingbeats.com, and click Support the Show, where you can make either a one-time or a recurring donation. As we look to continue having cliche-free conversations of real substance with a diverse range of the world's most compelling people, your support is so appreciated, especially as we look to expand and increase our offerings. If you have a question, comment, or thought, find us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or if you wish to reach out directly, email me at daniel@talkingbeats.com. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get on with today's conversation. On today's program, we're speaking with millennial climate activist Daniel Sherrell. The organizer, born in 1990, led the campaign to pass landmark climate justice legislation in the state of New York. He's recently out with a book, his first one called Warmth, Coming of Age at the End of Our World, which is described as a new kind of book about climate change, not what it is or how we solve it, but how it feels to imagine a future and a family under its weight. It's a memoir, a love letter, and a work of criticism all at once. It goes to the defining question of our time: how do we go on in a world that may not? He proposes some strong and provocative ideas in the book. I'm pleased to welcome him here, Daniel Sherrell.
Thanks so much for having me, Daniel.
I'm holding your book in my hand here, Warmth, Coming of Age at the End of Our World. Not the most optimistic title, subtitle. When did you become interested in the climate in a way that is more than cursory? In fact, it drives you crazy, it drives you regularly to tears, it drives you to rage. When did this all start? You're about my age. I can't exactly relate, although I'm concerned, but clue me in here.
Yeah. I think for me, it started quite early when I was a little kid. I grew up in New Jersey, where my father works as an oceanographer at Rutgers University, which is a very cool job. He, you know, for months, most years during my childhood, he would take off on a research cruise to Antarctica, where he studied esoteric things having to do with plankton blooms and particulates in the ocean. But I first heard the term global warming, which was the term of art in the 90s, from him when I was like 8. He'd come back from Antarctica, and he seemed to me a little disturbed. And he would say things like, "It's not the same continent I went to a decade ago." Things were really changing very rapidly down there, and that's true. Because of the albedo effect with the ice, the poles actually warm quicker than any other place on the planet. And this was disturbing for an 8-year-old who, like, I love National Geographic. I felt myself to be deeply interested in and excited about the natural world. To hear from my father this sort of vague notion that something drastic was changing on this distant continent and would eventually arrive at our doorstep. I remember feeling kind of shocked that, like, not everybody I knew was talking about this constantly, given that what my dad seemed to express about the magnitude of the problem, I didn't understand why I'd basically never heard anybody else talk about it.
Okay, if there's people who aren't talking about it as much as you wish, why don't you lay out the magnitude of the problem right now for those listening who don't have a clue what you're talking about? What is the magnitude of the problem, put simply?
The changing of Earth's climate has been driven basically since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution by the human species powering our economies with fossil fuels. What those fossil fuels do when you burn them is they add carbon to the atmosphere. And you can think of carbon in the atmosphere as a big blanket. The more carbon, the thicker the blanket, and the more warmth it traps here on planet Earth with us, rather than dissipating into space. We have now emitted more carbon into the atmosphere. The magnitude of the problem is that if we continue on our current trajectory, we continue powering our economy with fossil fuels and burn fossil fuels at the same rate we do today, human civilization will not be able to be sustained long-term, or perhaps even through the end of the century. We are seeing levels of warming already that are causing truly cataclysmic events, like the flooding we saw in Germany earlier this week, or aggressive heat domes out in the Pacific Northwest that are sending temperatures in Vancouver, Canada, soaring past 117 degrees Fahrenheit. We have emitted a level of carbon to the atmosphere. We'll only get worse from here before they get better. And if we don't change course and really restructure our economy in the next 20 to 30 years to remove fossil fuels as its power source and instead power our activities with renewable energy, then we're headed towards a place where the food and water security of the entire planet, and especially of poor people on this planet, are thrown into chaos. And we can't grow enough food to feed everybody. There isn't enough water to go around. Not to mention that the coastlines will be receding because of sea level rise. There'll be more extreme and more frequent weather events like hurricanes and tornadoes. And we're already seeing this play out. So the stakes here are not like, you know, some polar bears in the Arctic or a few people in some very distant countries. The stakes that we're dealing with are like the very foundations of human civilization and whether they will be preserved. And those are at real risk in the coming century. And what we do, whether we keep warming to below 2 degrees Celsius or ideally 1.5, or we let it skyrocket to 3, 4, 5, the differences in those number of degrees, though they seem small, spell the difference between tragedies like we're seeing currently and like an utter rending of the social fabric. Again, and the thing that really drives this home for me is like the last time that carbon levels were this concentrated in the atmosphere, there were vast oceans in the middle of this continent, and there were tropical animals like crocodiles living in northern Canada. We're really kind of playing with the geology of our planet in a very dangerous way that we don't have control over. And so we need to maintain control. And that involves curtailing the vast power of the one industry on this planet that is incentivized to continue to see the world burn. And that is the fossil fuel industry and the politicians they've bought.
Okay, what are fossil fuels?
Fossil fuels are coal, oil, and gas. Any fuel that is formed basically by an organic compound being compressed, pressurized, and stored over millennia in the ground and then dug up through various drilling, fracking, and mining techniques.
You talk about the fact that it's not going to be a severe storm in 50 years, or maybe a little flooding or a lot of flooding in Germany, or a heat dome over in the Pacific Northwest. It's going to be earth changing in a way that it's going to upheave the society. What do you mean? How is that going to happen? Paint a picture. You're good at painting bleak pictures. You do it for 200 pages here. How is that going to happen?
I hope I'm not only painting bleak pictures, because I don't think any of this is inevitable or hopeless. I don't think we're in a hopeless situation. David Wallace Wells has done this very well in his book, The Uninhabitable World, sketching out what the worst case scenarios look like. But essentially what they look like is a world where growing seasons are thrown so out of whack and are so chaotic and shortened in many places that we literally can't produce enough calories as a global society to keep everybody from starving. And what it also looks like is water reserves that we've relied on for millennia to provide water to our cities, etc., those drying up or being severely reduced, like we're already seeing out west with Lake Mead, for instance. As those fundamentals of human society shift under our feet and become more scarce and less predictable, that causes massive migrations of thousands and millions of people across international borders seeking safety, which has the potential to lead to like the destabilizing of various political orders, especially if the right wing is in control and essentially solves that problem with guns and borders rather than with assistance and welcome. And then what it looks like
is... Well, it's not just because the right wing, because you in this book, there's this section in which you go after a group of people who you call pseudo-democrats. So it's not just the right wing, unless you're including these pseudo-democrats, as you call them, in the right wing. The problem seems to extend farther across the political spectrum, no?
Yeah, Absolutely. I'm not, when I say right wing, I don't necessarily mean only Republicans. There are plenty of Democrats who for decades have subscribed to a neoliberal economic model that has preferenced the profit margins of the fossil fuel companies over the integrity of planet Earth. So I think I think the Republican Party is truly off the rails when it comes to climate change and has no response to the biggest catastrophe facing humanity in the 21st century. There are many people in the Democratic Party who haven't acted with nearly enough urgency given the scale of the problem. So you're totally right.
And you have to, of course, bear in mind that while this may be the issue of the next century or of now, there are a lot of other issues and a lot of things to balance when you're running for office from a purple state or even a non-bright blue state. Of course, politicians have to take in mind what is going to get them elected. And certainly finding a balance, right? I mean, it's as right as you may be, as correct as you may be, there are compromises that have to be made when it comes to, is Senator X, Y, or Z going to be able to win re-election? Balancing the issues.
Yeah, I mean, I would push back against that a little bit. I mean, we're basically caught between a rock and a hard place, right? The hard place is politics, and the rock is physics. And politics is negotiable, right? If you're motivated enough, you can figure out, not always, but there are ways to rejigger your messaging, to take a different posture, to organize better, etc. Political realities, in other words, are dynamic. The principles of physics and the cascading chain of events that adding carbon to the atmosphere triggers, that is non-negotiable. We cannot negotiate with physics. So we can proceed from a place of what we currently perceive to be politically possible and then fail on the margins of physics, thus condemning large sections of society to a huge amount of suffering over the next century. Or we can do everything possible that we can to shift the Overton window, to change the political dynamics so that we can take the actions necessary to allay that grievous harm from the climate crisis. I think the frustration, and again, we're diving deep into politics here, but the frustration of many in the climate movement is that even those folks from purple districts who naturally have to get reelected, it doesn't seem oftentimes like they're trying everything in their power to make the politics work so they can pass aggressive climate change legislation. They're thinking much more myopically than that, and they're thinking about the next election cycle, which of course is important. But there was a tweet I enjoyed recently from the climate journalist Jake Biddle. Some Blue Dog Democrat was raising the prospect of this big infrastructure bill that would do things like fund a transition to renewable energy and strengthen childcare for poor families and rebuild our roads and bridges and increase the speed of broadband, et cetera, et cetera. And the Democrat in question was like, well, you know, I'm not going to support something this big because, you know, that would risk my election back home in my district. Table for a second that I think his analysis of the opinions and the political potential in his district are flawed. But the logic there is essentially, we have to do nothing this term so we can get reelected and continue to do nothing the following term. Or if nothing is too ungenerous, then take actions that are fundamentally inadequate to the problem.
Would you rather that person be replaced by a Republican who did nothing on climate change and then did everything you didn't like on every other issue?
I think that because, I mean, this is really getting into inside baseball here. I'd respond in 2 points. I think, one, those centrist Democrats have been blinded by neoliberal politics for a long time and actually don't think that their base, Republican or Democrat, in their districts gives a shit about deficit politics. And once they see money being spent on their community, in their communities, on green jobs and new infrastructure, that will actually be a very popular thing if the politician in question can own that narrative. But even if that weren't true, and we have this one shot, the first shot in truly decades, to pass something on the magnitude of the New Deal and reorder how our economy is powered and who it's worked for, it might be worth it for a few marginal Democrats to fall on their sword to get something as monumental as that passed. Because if the logic is always like, we have to maintain this majority at all costs, no matter what's on the table, no matter the stakes, then we basically, you know, continue to tie one hand behind our back at all times. And the stalemate or the lack of adequate action lasts in perpetuity. Because I think the one thing that people confuse with climate change is like, it's not like taking a good step is the same as taking an adequate step, right? A lot of these blue dog Democrats, they support renewable energy. They're like, yeah, invest in my community, wind and solar, it's great. But if you're not investing at the scale required, like there is a temperature increase on this planet past which various feedback loops, including the release of buried methane from the Siberian Arctic and albedo effects, including involving the ice at the poles, those feedback mechanisms are triggered. And then we're in an even worse scenario than we are now in a way that's very hard to come back from. So I think there's also this logic where like any forward, any incremental forward momentum on climate change is positive. And that's actually not true. I would argue if your car is driving towards a cliff, turning the wheel 20 degrees won't save you. You'll still go off the cliff at a slightly different angle. You have to turn it 90 degrees, the full 90, in order to save yourself. And there's really not a lot of wiggle room there. Then what
should happen? Should every politician who doesn't align with what you're saying resign right now, burn down the system, wait a few years, wait for all to be reshuffled? What do you propose?
Absolutely not. All I'm proposing is the radical notion that, for example, Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin should get behind a $4 trillion reconciliation package that deals with climate change. And look at the poll numbers from their own districts and realize the assumptions they've been operating under since the 70s, that any government spending is politically anathema in their district, is in fact deeply outdated. And if they own that, if they own that investment and people see their lives improving, then they will win re-election and we will pass some of the most important climate legislation of our lifetimes. But I certainly don't. Listen, I'm an organizer. I'm a progressive organizer. I don't think we should burn down the system. There are some leftists who do. I think if you look historically, when a governmental system truly crumbles to the ground, rarely does something more benevolent and ordered and equal arise in its wake, like a phoenix. Usually it's something far scarier. So I don't think all those people should resign. I just think they should step up to the gravity of the moment they're legislating in and make history rather than tie their hands behind their back because of on the most important issue, arguably, of our lifetime, certainly for younger generations, because of outmoded analyses about what's palatable to their districts.
To their states, because they represent entire states, not districts, being senators. But that aside, I take your point. In this book, you basically divide it into various parts, various chapters, various sections. One is called Outrage, and I wanted to highlight this because you go into depth on a name that people will remember from early on in the Trump administration. It's a very emblematic person. He's a symbolic person for a lot of where you direct your personal outrage, and I'm talking about Scott Pruitt. Can you talk about this man and why he became a sort of central focus, at least for a number of pages in this book, of yours? What is it about? Let me just read a little bit from here. Quoting here, one of these men was Scott Pruitt. In 2018, the year I began writing this letter, he was partway through his tenure as head of the federal agency tasked with protecting the environment. What was disorienting about Pruitt was that he fit so neatly into the far more familiar mold of the garden variety corrupt politician. He was clean-cut and forgettable-looking, an avowed Christian who insisted on the constant company of a 10-person armed security detail. He would circle the country in first class, spending ludicrous amounts of taxpayer money attending meetings with the fossil fuel executives he was meant to regulate, hosting carefully curated events with hand-picked audiences, giving out shady contracts to former associates. In his first months in office, he flew his entire security detail to Italy, where he was photographed alone in front of the Vatican, squinting and smiling into the sun. Back home in Oklahoma, he'd been the proud co-owner of a minor league baseball team, the Oklahoma City Redhawks. It was difficult to comprehend that this was the person responsible for undermining the science that warned of the problem, climate change, dismantling the policies that might have contained it, and pursuing an aggressive course of fossil fuel expansion certain to exacerbate it. It was an evil that was difficult to keep in focus, so the press tended to concentrate more on his pedestrian sleaze, the scandals for which they already had a playbook. How'd you come to focus on Scott Pruitt? What does he symbolize for you?
Yeah, I came to focus on Scott Pruitt because I'm genuinely, he represents a kind of person that I'm genuinely confused by. And by confused, I mean, I can't imagine what goes on inside their head. The course of action they've chosen to take in their life, which is to bolster by any means necessary the fossil fuel industry, which is destroying the planet, and undermine any attempts to question its hegemony and transition to renewable energy. They know these are not dumb people. They know that the best science coming out of our best universities, MIT, Harvard, Yale, literally any education institution of higher learning and research, indicates that pursuing the course of action they're pursuing will result in extremely dangerous levels of warming that put the lives and livelihoods of millions of people at risk, and that is extremely likely. These are the conclusions of the International Panel on Climate Change, which is generally considered a pretty conservative scientific body, and yet they continue to pursue that course of action anyway. I mean, obviously, it's enraging. It is unbelievable the license that these very rich men have taken with the lives of millions of poor people who their decisions affect. It's ethically grotesque. But it's also sort of like a weird form of sociopathy, you know? Like Hannah Arendt has that phrase, the banality of evil, and I think Scott Pruitt really sums it up. And when I'm grappling with the climate crisis, one place I go in my less healthy moments is like, what the fuck? What are these guys thinking? Like, I'm genuinely curious what it is like and what the structures of rationalization look like inside his head that allow him to pursue this course of action that I think can reasonably be argued is resulting in a genocide. And we're already seeing that genocide play out in places like Bangladesh, where farmers can no longer raise crops from the soil that's too saline, or all the way to Germany, where hundreds of people just drowned in millennial level floods directly attributable to climate change. The causal chains here aren't a mystery. We know about them. And Scott Pruitt notes about them. And instead of reacting to that science, he tries to bury it. So they became a symbol for me of a kind of a banal and unknowable evil that sort of preoccupies me sometimes when I'm feeling just like deep sadness and rage about what's being done to the planet and to my generation and those below me. The place I ultimately come to also about the Pruitts is like, it's not about them, you know? There are some very shitty people with a lot of money and a lot of power, and we have to regulate them and we have to take their political power away from them. Our orientation towards the climate crisis can't be grounded in loathing of those people. It's not worth our time and it's not politically effective. And in my healthier moments, and a thing I try to cultivate myself is like, the reason I engage in climate organizing work and have made it my life's work to try to use the metaphor I drew on earlier, steer the car away from the cliff, is because I love everybody in the car. It's like all my friends and family. It's the coastlines of my country and every country in the world. It's the seasons, the season called summer, which used to be about warm breezes and is now increasingly about fire tornadoes. The season called spring that barely occurs on the East Coast anymore. The blizzards that I remember so joyfully from my childhood are getting rarer and rarer in the Northeast, not to mention the biodiversity that's dropping off precipitously on this planet. And that is one of, I think, its chief beauties. There's so many things that I love that are at stake here. I try to fight primarily for them rather than against the Pruitts, although I still have to sort of like contend with and process my anger and my just honestly more than anger, disbelief at some of these people. And Pruitt's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there are a bunch of these guys, and they're mostly guys filling the upper ranks of the fossil fuel companies and the Republican Party and various lobbying and think tanks, etc. And, you know, Noam Chomsky has this line that I think is correct. I mean, given their posture to the climate and that they're doing everything to stand in the way of taking action on it, the Republic, and given the number of lives at stake from climate change, which is literally in the tens or hundreds of millions, Noam Chomsky argues that the Republican Party is the most dangerous organization on the planet in terms of the number of human lives they're putting at grave risk within our lifetimes. So I think anger is obviously legitimate, but and I process it in the book, but also try to move through it towards a higher motivation, which is about love, as cheesy as that sounds.
There's a part in the book where you are recounting a meeting with a philosophy professor in undergrad. I guess you went to Brown, is that right?
Yeah.
You are being called into her office, and you talk about a term paper you wrote, and she looks at you, and she says, this is a quote, I guess her quote, if you recounted it properly, quote, "So tell me about this environmentalism. I've never understood why I should care about one species of owl versus the next." And at the time, you say you couldn't produce a satisfying answer. In the moment, maybe you wanted to badly inhabit her point of view. Okay, good on you. What's the answer?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm still not sure I have an answer to that particular question. I mean, at the time, the reason I wanted to inhabit her point of view is there was a lightness to it, you know? The context of that conversation is this particular philosophy professor thought it was somewhat too quite likely that all of us are living in some sort of computer-generated simulation. And so for her, one owl versus the next, they're all bits of algorithm in this broader matrix that we live in. This is something, and this is an opinion held by some pretty legitimate philosophers and metaphysicians. And though I couldn't inhabit her viewpoint, I was jealous of it because it lent a lightness. It reduced the stakes on everything. If this is a simulation, although other philosophers would argue that even if it is a simulation, why does that reduce its ontological weight? But all of that aside, why is one owl important versus the next? I'd answer in two ways. One, I'm not an anthropocentrist, ultimately. I think there's something valuable inherently in the complexity and beauty of the various branches of the evolutionary tree that have resulted on this planet Earth, and that the disappearance of a species that has taken millennia to evolve, that has its whole own life world, its own subjectivity, its own interaction with the world around itself, the disappearance of that entirely is fundamentally a tragedy. But I would also question the premise of her question. That obviously is not primarily what climate action is about. Action on climate change, again, is not about saving the whales or any particular species of owl. It's about saving the entire ecosystem on which all of those things depend, including Homo sapiens, so that it all doesn't go up in flames. And I think, to me, that larger goal, which is very much the focus of the climate movement, is a to me, a priori worthy goal. But also, I like owls. They're cute.
You probably know that music plays a role in this show, and I talk about music with everybody, whether it's someone like you or a musician themselves or a physicist or ambassador or whatever. So unlike a lot of what we've been talking about, music is stable, and music offers a brightness and a light. What does music do for you?
I think music is one of the quickest short circuits I know to inhabiting a certain kind of mood. And it can be any sort of mood, depending on the song. But I often turn to music as sort of a reflection of my inner world and my emotional state. If I'm feeling very happy, playing a song, playing a happy song, or a song that rings happy to me, can amplify that feeling. And likewise, when I'm feeling grief. And it's always been sort of magical to me that a certain pattern of sound emerging from rhythmically struck objects, whether it's a metal chord or the top of a drum, that there are these certain objects in the world that you can kind of hit rhythmically, and they produce this extremely intense emotional response inside your brain. That's just a very weird alchemy to me, and something that I love. And it's also somewhere I turn, you know, climate organizing work is intense work, and it's often heavy. And obviously, writing this book was a means of trying to process that heaviness and arrive at a place of grace, and a grace that wasn't blind optimism or deflating despair. But the writing's my main mode. Music also helps me, and a late pandemic hobby of mine has been taking up playing the harmonica, which is perhaps not the most elegant instrument, but it's easily portable and deeply satisfying, I've found. And so often after a long day of meetings, I'll sit out on my porch and play an old Roy Orbison song or something. Shifts me radically out of the headspace I'd occupied only minutes before. So it's something I'm very grateful for in my life generally.
What does the life of a climate organizer look like? What is it? You go to meetings, you meet with politicians, you meet with each other. How do you get things done?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would say there's not one answer. The way this sort of climate organizing and activism that I engage in is certainly not the only mold it can look like. You know, the indigenous leaders at the Standing Rock protests out in the Dakotas, they were engaged in climate activism, or more recently, the fight around Line 3, the pipeline in Minnesota, the folks who were locking themselves down to that pipeline to make sure it didn't proceed. That's a form of climate organizing. But I would also argue that, like, organizing to unionize home healthcare aides, for example, who are having to take care of an aging population in increasingly dire climatic territory and are engaged in very important and carbon-free work, that organizing those people and making sure they can make a living wage is climate work. I actually think there's very little progressive political work that isn't related to climate at this point, because it does touch every aspect of our society. But for me in particular, so currently I'm the campaign director at an organization called the Climate Jobs National Resource Center, which is relatively new. And we are working with some of the major national labor unions to craft proactive strategies on climate policy that benefit working people and ensure that the renewable energy economy, that jobs in the renewable energy economy look more like unionized careers than they do gigs at McDonald's or Uber. So day to day, it's a lot of...
Like what specifically? What kind of jobs are you talking about?
What kind of jobs? Oh, everything from, you know, the classic installing residential solar panels or manufacturing and erecting turbines to retrofitting a building envelope to make it more energy efficient, to painting the roof of that building, again, to make it more energy efficient. And it spans all the way to jobs remediating ecosystems that are damaged by climate change or make us more resilient, like mangrove forests on coastlines that reduce storm surge. There's a lot. There's like a huge color wheel of climate-related, quote-unquote, green jobs that can be discussed in the context of the Green New Deal, for instance. But suffice to say that the best science is telling us that we have to really rebuild our economy from the ground up over the next 30 years and change entirely how it's powered. That is going to take a huge amount of labor. And will that labor that is saving all of our asses be well-paid, family-sustaining, or will it be exploitative contract labor? And I would argue that not only is the latter unethical, but it will lead to us not adequately tackling the climate crisis. So that's my brief aside, but it's a lot of email. It's a lot of Zoom meetings. It's like in-person strategy sessions. It's meeting with politicians. It's going to actions, whether that be a rally or a sit-in or a press conference. You know, the way we get things done. I mean, the basic DNA of a climate campaign, I think, won't be a mystery to anyone. You decide on your policy goal, like, okay, we want, for example, all the schools in this municipality to be solarized and retrofitted by the year 2030. That will save X amount of carbon, create X amount of jobs, save the schools X number of dollars. We identify a campaign target who can give it to us. Maybe it's the mayor, maybe it's the school superintendent. We do a thing called power mapping that target. So figure out, what does this person care about? Who do they listen to? What constituencies or individuals influence their decisions? And then we create a strategy and a campaign plan around moving the actors on that power map to get this target to change their tune and do the right thing. And so that's the basic DNA. So it's a lot of thinking about that and then operationalizing it. And much of it is not very glamorous. It involves spreadsheets, et cetera. And then there are moments where it's, I don't know, the most joyful and meaningful thing I feel like I've ever been involved in, to think creatively alongside a team of people across identities, across sectors, who stand in solidarity around a shared set of values and are trying to enact them in the world. There's as mundane as it is day to day, overall, there's a deep beauty there, I think.
What politicians do you find are receptive to what you're talking about? Who can you reach out to who has a platform and say, can we look at this? Can we please look at this? Whose arm can you twist?
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty. I mean, the amazing thing about the climate movement and the progressive movement writ large is that it really has moved the climate crisis to the absolute center of the political debate. And so you have somebody like Joe Biden, who 5 years ago was barely talking about climate change at all. Now his talk of solving climate change by creating millions of jobs, that is like one, if not the top talking point of his administration and the cornerstone of this big reconciliation bill they're trying to get through Congress. So I would say the answer to your question is more and more of them, and not just the AOCs of the world, but the President Bidens of the world are coming along and seeing the urgency and seeing the scale of what we need to undertake, but also the benefits of what doing that action will confer on society. And that didn't happen magically because these people woke up and realized what was right or what was wrong. It happened by social movements and organizing, changing over years what was politically possible and what was politically popular. So that though Obama, when he was inaugurated, was sort of treated as a progressive champion, and a lot of progressives were less excited about Biden because he had a reputation as a sort of ideological centrist. In fact, because the political terrain has changed so much between those two administrations, Biden is legislating on all issues, but especially on climate, in a much more progressive way than Barack Obama ever did. And I think in large part, you have the climate movement to thank for that. And also the fact that with each passing year, the evidence of the gravity of climate change is getting more and more in our face. You can't look at a temperature like 117 in Vancouver, Canada, and really think this isn't the thing.
To a lot of people, all of this would sound rather overwhelming. What if someone wants to get involved, but they can't throw themselves in the way you are? If they have a little extra cash, maybe, or a little extra interest, what can they do? You list a few websites in the back of the book. Mm-hmm. Or if they just want to learn more, they don't know if they want to be involved, but they want to learn a little bit more, what should they be doing?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. And one of the things I'll say off the bat is, for folks who feel overwhelmed by the climate crisis, I'm with you. There are many days where I feel overwhelmed by the climate crisis, and that should not be something you feel bad about. It's a very rational response to an incredibly dire situation we're in. But what I've found in response to overwhelm is it's not that you have to feel hope and on top of things before you take action. I think the causal chain is actually the reverse, that once you start taking action, that's where the hope comes from. I think getting involved in social movements has been the most meaningful experience of my life, not only because I'm in solidarity with so many people that are trying to create a beautiful, more equitable society, but because I'm engaged with the major political currents and historical currents of my time that feels important. So all of which is to say, getting involved in the climate movement shouldn't feel overwhelming to you. It's actually one solution I've found to the feeling of overwhelm. So with that caveat aside, the two organizations that I list at the back of the book are the Sunrise Movement and the Climate Justice Alliance. The Sunrise Movement is an amazing organization that organizes young people around the climate crisis and is incredibly politically effective and strategically savvy. And the Climate Justice Alliance is doing incredible work all across the country with the communities hardest hit by the climate crisis, mostly poor communities, mostly communities of color and indigenous communities, to make sure that those people aren't the victims of climate change, but in fact, leading the way out of it and leading the transition towards a more equitable society. Whether you have 5 minutes a week or 5 hours a week. There are ways for you to plug in. And for me, I structure it. If you kind of want to dip your toe in and you don't want it, you're a bit overwhelmed, you don't know where to get involved, sit down with yourself and answer two questions. A, is it important to me to be involved in the movement fighting climate change, given what I know about its gravity? And B, set yourself an amount of time. You can give a week or a month, you know? Literally everything is useful. But if it's 5 minutes a week, great. You're making one call to Chuck Schumer or whoever your senator is once a week, and that really helps. If it's more than that, you can get more deeply involved. I think the key is to make it feel manageable and iterative and strategic. And there are an incredible number of organizations that do work along those lines. But again, Sunrise Movement and the Climate Justice Alliance, you get in touch with those folks, they will get you doing politically useful, satisfying work tomorrow if you want.
What's the next step for you? What do you hope to accomplish? What do you hope to do? You want to run for office? What do you want to do?
Well, this is a question I ask myself on many a morning. I think I'm going to be working in and around the climate movement for the rest of my life. This is a problem that is not going to go magically away, and that implicates everything I care about. And it honestly feels like an honor to be able to work with it, with my time and with my days. Right now, I'm doing a lot of work, as I said, organizing labor unions to take a more politically active and strategic role in combating the climate crisis, and to make sure that policies involving the climate crisis benefit workers rather than grind them into the dirt. Beyond that, there's this tricky balance between being involved in the work and then taking time to actually process what that involvement has meant to me. And to be honest, when I wrote this book, I took a step back completely from organizing. For a full year and a half, I basically only focused on writing, partially because I felt like if I didn't, through writing, unfurl this like knot of thought and feeling that was kind of building up in my chest in the trenches of the climate movement, then I wouldn't be able to keep doing the work. But also because processing and acting at the same time, I find to be very hard. I don't have any specific and very satisfying thing, but I guess I want to live a life where those two sides of myself, the side that's concerned with inquiry and beauty and the side that's concerned with political change in order to protect many of the people and things that I love, to have those two sides of myself be able to feed off of and weave into each other rather than be separated into two different silos. And I don't know what that looks like. There are not many models out there, but yeah, I don't know. There are a few figures in history or even contemporary figures that I feel like do that sort of thing with grace. I'm thinking of Arundhati Roy, the Booker Prize winning author, who's also an influential and effective socialist in India. Or I'm thinking of like Vaclav Havel, who was an incredible writer. I don't know. Those people I really admire, and they haven't fallen either into the trap of like a writer in their garret, like squirreled away from the world and sort of unconcerned with its mortal foibles. And on the other end, like a political animal who's just like an operator sending emails at like 11 p.m. and like totally sucked into the world of power. I want to figure out a way to marry the two and have them inform each other. So it's sort of an abstract goal, but it's one that feels important to me.
Well, I wish you all the luck in the world. And I guess I wish us all the luck in the world. According to you, we're going to need it. And I guess we're going to need people like you. If you run for office, come here for your first appearance.
I appreciate that, Daniel. And whether it's me running or me helping somebody else run, that could be in my future. But the other thing I'll say is I think we do need luck. But mostly what we need, we're still in control of this situation. We still can decide as people, as a society, which direction we want to turn the wheel of the car. That is still within our power. And so more than luck, it's going to take solidarity and love and organizing. And I think we're seeing, you know, especially from progressive movements in this country, more and more of those things every day. So I don't want to end on like an obligatorily hopeful note, because that's such a move in climate conversations. Like, I do think we're in a fucking awful situation. But the posture I would recommend, even for your sanity and mental health, is not one of like passive fingers crossed, but of active involvement in where we're headed. And I think there are still, even though the situation is very dire right now, a huge fan of outcomes that lay ahead of us, and it's up to us to choose between them.
Daniel Sherrill, the book Warmth, coming of age at the end of our world. Hopefully not, sir, but indeed, I thank you.
Thank you so much, Daniel. This is a real pleasure.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.